Some of you may have noticed... some of you may have noticed that there was a Miss Schaefer who was to be moderator, and I am not her. My name is Alan Rudy, and she was unable to attend. I think there was a flight connection issue. This is panel 4205 at 10:30 on Friday morning. And the name of it is Your Brain, the 3-pound universe. It goes on to say, the brain's neuroplasticity allows it to adapt and respond to changes. And I don't know if any of you saw this morning's report. Okay, got better? Thank you. Don't know if any of you saw this morning's report that the Kelly brothers, the astronauts, had... Really?
It's loud up here.
Yeah, it's really loud.
Yeah.
Is it a different mic, maybe? Should you...
Is that better? Okay, I'll do it this way. This morning, there was a report that the Kelly brothers, the twins, the astronauts, had been undergoing extensive tests. As you know, one of them spent a year in space. And some 300 scientists were comparing the various components of their systems to see how the prolonged period in space would impact anyone doing it. And among the changes that were noticed, all of which were temporary, was cognitive ability. And so this panel is particularly on target and on time. Now, just a quick note in terms of asking questions. There's a great app, and should you have it, on the app is a live question and answer button which you can push. Write your question, and I will get it up here. If you'd rather... you can write a note and have it sent up here. And where are the folks with the... Would you raise your hands, those of you who have... Is there anybody out there? Where are you? Okay, if you need a piece of paper to write your question on, raise your hand, and it will be delivered to you. If you are a student, note on the paper or the question to me that you are a student. If you're not, don't. I'm going to make a very, very brief introduction because there are bios in your program. And beginning on my far left is Maria. Let me do it this way. Most of you have probably heard the story of John Kennedy entertaining a group of Nobel laureates in a room in the White House. And he said that only time that more brain power was ever present in this room was when Thomas Jefferson was eating alone. And I tell that story because... on this panel, Thomas Jefferson would come in second. We have a great group of neuroscientists who are accomplished, productive, and will be tremendously informative. And in addition to them, Becky, on the far right, is a world expert dealing with bees, and part of her experience now is that they are mating a bee culture with veterans in an effort to enhance the quality of their life and maybe support some of the deficiencies. So we really are looking forward to a panel that will be informative and exciting. And with that, would you like to begin?
Good morning.
Thank you. Thank you, Ellen. And please let me know if you can't hear me. Just, you know, raise your hand. Make some noise, okay? Is this okay? Is this loud enough? Okay. So I'll always remember, as a first-year medical student, cradling the human brain in my hands for the first time. And I was overcome by awe and wonder. You know, how could this 3-pound structure have encoded every single thought, emotion, action, and memory over a lifetime? Since then, there's been an incredible explosion in our understanding of the human brain, and I'm just thrilled to be here today to discuss this. And I'd like to start off by congratulating each and every one of you who's here at the Conference of World Affairs, and also everybody who's helped organizing this, because just by being here, meeting new people, immersing yourself in new ideas and new concepts, is really wonderful for your brain. It's like sprinkling your brain with Miracle-Gro.
Which and, may not sound good, but it is.
And that's because every experience physically changes your brain. So even as you're listening to this talk today, your brain is changing. The brain you leave with at the end of this talk is going to be physically different than the one you came in with. This is the miracle of neuroplasticity. And what we now understand, and let me just define neuroplasticity. This is the remarkable ability of your brain to form new neural connections throughout your life. The miracle begins in infancy. A newborn baby has 100 billion neurons. And each of these 100 billion neurons is connected to 2,500 other neurons through synapses. And by age 2 to 3, the number has increased exponentially to 15,000 connections per neuron. And by adulthood, the human brain has a mind-boggling 100 trillion synapses. This elaborate tapestry of connections is woven by neuroplasticity with purpose, manifesting this progressive evolution of proficiency and skill. A babbling vocalizations will evolve into eloquent speech. A toddler wobbling on legs will transform into an Olympic 100-meter sprinter. And simple object permanence, which is the most rudimentary type of thought, evolves into the ability to solve complicated world problems. Although neuroplasticity is most robust in infancy and early childhood, it continues throughout our lives, and it's never too late to tap into its power, to tap into this power of your brain to improve and redesign itself. Enhancing neuroplasticity builds up your brain's resilience to neurologic insults and to aging. It's like making a deposit into your brain's 401k account. As a neurologist, I care for patients with memory disorders, strokes, and other neurologic diseases, and I contemplate this miracle of neuroplasticity on a daily basis. At our new McCants Center for Brain Health at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, we're doing a tremendous amount of research on how we can harness this power of neuroplasticity and preserve and enhance brain function across the lifespan. So I'd like to end with a little brain teaser. What do you call a skull that is missing its 100 billion neurons? Come on, can't anybody come up with the answer? It's a no-brainer.
Your timing was absolutely perfect.
Go for it.
Thank you, Marie. Wow, that was a great introduction. So I'm a neuroscientist. I'm a biologist of the brain. I've been studying the brain for the past about 3 decades, and I too was fortunate to hold a human brain in my hands as a recently graduated from college person, and it was an amazing experience to me, and I had some of the same thoughts, and it really led me to want to study the brain for my life's work. So I want to mention a few things about the scientific study of plasticity. So we think about it in a number of different levels. So at the most minute level, we can study the molecules, the genes, and the cells, and how they change with experience. And that, to me, was like the most fascinating idea, these physical, chemical, structural changes that take place in the brain. What are they, and how does that all work? And that was really the idea that captured my attention and got me going in this direction to study plasticity. But what we also need to, as scientists, try to understand the conditions that surround plasticity, and also when that plasticity occurs, what is the meaning of that plasticity in terms of how it would influence our cognition and our behavior? And I think those are really the important sort of scientific levels of questions that we try to address when we're looking at neuroplasticity. And so I want to just mention a number of different points here in a nutshell, and then maybe we can come back to them if you're interested and have some questions about them. So one point, not all neuroplasticity is good. So I in my lab, study the neural processes that underlie drug addiction. And exposure to traumatic events in our lives, exposure to things like chronic exposure to drugs of abuse, can produce plastic changes in the brain that really aren't beneficial. And so when you talk about neuroplasticity, and we most often think of it as, in terms of learning and useful things, but it also can be deleterious. And so we're trying to understand that from a neuroscientific perspective. So the other kind of counterpoint to that is not all plasticity that occurs as a result of those kind of exposure to traumatic experiences or to, for example, drugs that people abuse, not all that plasticity is bad, because we're finding that maybe it's not so surprising, that we're incredibly resilient as organisms, and we have ways to sort of counteract things that are deleterious. And so it's just, to me, a fascinating but complicated challenge to try to understand. We can observe plasticity of many different kinds in response to stimuli, but some of those might be useful and some of them might be not useful. And so disentangling that is a really hot topic in neuroscience and a really actually pretty challenging problem. Mental neurological disorders have as principal components neuroplasticity. So we often think about brain damage in something like, for example, Parkinson's disease. We know that certain neurons die and that produces a problem. In Alzheimer's disease, especially in the later years, there's a lot of neural damage. And so it's sort of obvious to be able to think of, okay, well, neural function is going to be diminished when we have that kind of damage. But in something like PTSD and something like addiction, we don't see that damage so clearly. What we think is that there's a rewiring, and so this rewiring is neuroplasticity. And so understanding that can give us a window into mental disorders, and it can also give us some windows into what we hope are new treatments for those mental disorders, because the treatments might have as a principal component neuroplasticity. If we know how to harness it better, we can perhaps help those people who can't help themselves. Most of this work is done in animals, and the reason for that is because a couple reasons. One, it's very difficult in people to look before and after to see what has changed. We don't often have that opportunity. Try to design experiments where we have that opportunity, but it's just very challenging in people. So, in these kind of animal studies, we have that opportunity, and we are learning a lot about plasticity from studying these. We don't have the tools yet in people to do non-invasive brain imaging of the kind that we would need to see the plasticity. It's at a very minute level. And so looking at, for example, formation of new synapses and things like that is not something we can yet do in people. But when we can, we're moving in that direction. We'll have tools to look at how experiences that people have that are beneficial for them. And I'm thinking of things like, for example, meditation, which changes your brain, but we don't yet exactly know how. I think that's going to help an emerging of alternative kinds of therapies that people are experimenting with, and Western medicine in a way that's really going to be great for everybody. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Peter Whitehouse. You have only heard half of the story. I'm a MD from Hopkins. I ran the brain bank at Hopkins and then became a story banker, because I think the stories we tell are as important, and of course our brains are an important part of telling stories, and the stories we tell about the brain and the universe. My own PhD work, before I got involved in that, was studying the left and the right hemispheres of the brain. So when I say you've only heard half the story, it's not an insult. It's you're hearing the left hemisphere talk. Once we get over here, bees do have hemispheres, but they'll be buzzing, and you'll have to listen to their communication patterns in a different way. There's a lot that's said about the left and the right hemisphere. I want to refer you to a book by my friend Ian McGilchrist, where he talks about the divided brain and the making of the Western world. He believes that the language, logical, linear, left hemisphere, which controls the language of space, is the Silvio Berlusconi hemisphere of the brain. There's an awful lot going on in the right hemisphere, and sometimes they're connected and sometimes they're not. Some of you may have been in this room yesterday for the wisdom panel, and we had an artist sitting over there interpreting what we were saying in visual images. Right, the right hemisphere was represented in that fashion. But it's not a simple difference. The right hemisphere is involved in language. It's involved, for example, in metaphor, drawing connections between each things. The right hemisphere is much more interested not in linearity, but in complexity, and pays attention to the world in much different ways than the left hemisphere does. I will say, Maria, I apologize, the notion of brain plasticity as Miracle-Grow introduces lots of metaphors, chemical metaphors, growth metaphors, so it gets us thinking about what that metaphor means to us. Ramón y Cajal was a Spanish neuroscientist who got the Nobel Prize for discovering something very fundamental about the brain. It's a series of individual neurons that connect with each other. It's not one network of wires. I mean, somebody else could have designed a brain that way. So it was the notion of an individual neuron. He was fighting with Golgi around this idea, was the brain individual neurons or not? Do you know how he came to the insight? He was taking a train that he would take regularly, and he would pass a forest. And he realized, by looking at it in the wintertime, that a forest, the brain, could be composed of individual neurons, trees. So the metaphor of trees actually paid a really significant role in his insight that won him his Nobel Prize. Let me just say that I have a little bit of a concern about neuroplasticity. I am a neurologist. I'm a cognitive neuroscientist. Why? I think before we even before we knew much about the brain at all, we knew the brain could change. What educator would tell you that psychoplasticity doesn't occur? I mean, Maria said your brain is going to leave here. But it's not just about your brain. It's about the It's about what you learn, the psychology. The brain is plastic, but so are our minds. And for that matter, in this world today, I think we don't pay enough attention to cultural plasticity, to socioplasticity, because quite frankly, this is a cultural event. So I'm not saying that brains are irrelevant to this, but when you call something neuroplasticity, you bring attention to the brain, not to how we learn together. And that's the concern I have. Brain plasticity is, neuroplasticity has been a very successful marketing on behalf of neuroscientists. Let me end with one other metaphor, and it's in our title. The brain is the 3-pound universe. What does that mean? I suppose there are some people that believe you have 14 billion years of experience and Lord knows how many miles of space in your brain. In some sense you do, because we are the human species that is trying to understand the brain in a way that that we know that it, we believe that it started 14 billion years ago. And it's amazing that our brain, to pay homage to the brain, is a little different than bees. I don't know what the bees' appreciation of the universe is. Maybe we'll learn that later. But the idea that we have that capability is amazing. So I had to decide whether I was going to end this comment with a bang or a whimper. Of course, it's easy to end with a bang because, you know, we started with a big bang, so we could, you know, talk about the universe at that large scale. But I hate to disappoint you. I'm going to end with a whimper. We're going to go to quantum chromodynamics, quantum mechanics, because there actually are people that believe that our brain and our consciousness plays a very important role in how consciousness is manifest in the universe itself. The only problem with quantum mechanics is that teaches us that we're all just basically probability fields. There is a non-zero chance that this audience will disappear in 5 seconds. So I'm going to stop.
Okay. Can everybody hear me? Thanks. How many beekeepers do I have here? Okay, so I have about 95% of you I need to convince in the next 5 minutes that opening a colony of 50,000 stinging insects is extremely relaxing. How am I doing so far? So, I have a wonderful job. I run a program called the Bee Squad for the University of Minnesota Bee Lab, and we are the outreach and extension arm for both a native bee and a honeybee lab. I have a team of about 18 employees, and we are tasked with a number of different programs that aim to, one, train beekeepers so that they're good beekeepers and they keep our honeybees healthy, and two, we're really tasked with bringing bee health information to the public, which I can't go here now because we're talking about brains. But three, our third goal is to bring some creative community programming that intersects bees and people, the public. So we have one program called Bee Arts, where we have received a few different grants, and we are actively coordinating with artists, and we are talking about science, talking about bee health, and letting them interpret what that means and then share it with the public. Because sometimes scientists are not the best at actually sharing information like bee health topics to the public. So we let them interpret it as far as in sculptures and in different programs. And then the other program that I'm actually here to talk about today is something we started in 2015 called Bee Veterans. And that is where we are bringing together free beekeeping instruction to military veterans. And this started because of a conversation, a series of conversations over a honeybee colony. Retired Lieutenant Colonel Michael Roach, who's no longer with us, he spent 20 years in the military, in the Marine Corps, and he spent time in Vietnam as well as multiple other deployments. And he was so concerned with our military veterans today returning from their deployments. And he also was in love with honeybees. And he knew, and he had the biggest hands, so he got stung a lot. But he knew that when he opened up a colony, there would be this relaxing, transformative feeling, and he would leave that colony a happier person. And he was also at the same time for a decade fighting cancer. And so he was using honeybees as his own therapy to get through that cancer fight. And so what he said to me in those conversations was that I want to support a program where you're training military veterans. So that was the birth of Bee Veterans. And when we did it, we had the long-term goal of being able to present this this process of getting into a colony and learning how to manage these honeybees and present it to beekeepers, or sorry, to veterans who potentially had PTSD. But we didn't start there. We started at how do we get veterans and get them into an apiary and start teaching them about beekeeping and make sure that we're covering all of our bases, because we're not going to be actually doing therapy. We're just going to see what kind of program works, because we consulted with veterans, we consulted with therapists, epidemiologists, and what they told us is that we have to be careful, because if you do have PTSD, one, there's a really good chance you want to be isolated. Two, there are triggers. We use smoke in beekeeping. That could be a trigger. We also have found a partner in the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport, so we have a very nice, open, spacious apiary right alongside the airport, which also means another trigger, which is an airplane, could be a problem. So we learned how to get into this instruction by paying attention, but also not trying to do therapy. And it wasn't until a month ago, that we submitted our first interdisciplinary grant, because we're very good at working with bees, and we're very good at teaching people how to manage bees, but we're not good at studying people. And so at the University of Minnesota, we've just applied for our first interdisciplinary grant, where we're working with a psychologist, we're working with a neurologist. We're also working with two extension programs that are specialists in dealing with military veterans and their families. And the Bee Lab and the Bee Squad, we're all working together to start our first studies to actually see if what we believe, the beekeeping, can be beneficial to people who have symptoms with PTSD. And we're really excited about it. And I'm just going to tell you that the father of modern beekeeping in 1833 said that he actually got into beekeeping to help him with his head troubles. So we're not the first to think about it, but we are excited to see if we will be an alternative therapy for veterans and others potentially who are suffering from those issues.
Thank you.
You're going to get another shot. We're going to take a few minutes for our guests to speak with one another, ask questions, or reflect on what others of them said. And Becky, if you want to start, you don't have to, but if there was anything that occurred to you, go for it.
So, Dr. Thomas, I'm trying to figure out if I can teach rats how to keep bees as a first step in this study.
I have to get a grant first. tough challenge.
So I'm going to ask Becky a question. Is it okay if we just eat more honey and don't actually, start our own colonies? But I'm going to ask a more serious question of Becky, because I think it relates to the whole conversation here. So Becky's doing a study, and she hired a neurologist. I'm guessing she's thinking about doing some brain imaging. You have a group of people, you do the beautiful brain intervention, and a group that you don't, and you want to determine whether that intervention is successful or not. And there are many ways that we can determine how things are successful. As Mark said, and everybody on the panel would know, you can get a grant, which usually means you have to do something like a randomized control study. Aside from the importance of telling stories, just the way you did, here's my question to the audience and to you. Would you prefer if the study that Becky did showed that some part of your brain was changed as a result of the intervention, or that you told people how wonderful it was and how your quality of life had improved? The reason I ask that question is one's a neurological marker, a marker of neuroplasticity, and the other's a measure of quality of life. And I know they can you can do both, so don't give me that argument. But which would you prefer?
So I'd like to get into that topic without answering that yes or no question, because I think both is really the answer, and I'm sorry that I have to... but you know, so I was sparked in thinking about something based on the comments you made, Peter, which are very useful. So neuroscience has made a lot of neuroplasticity. I think that's a good thing. But here's a couple reasons why I think it's a good thing, and why understanding the kind of plasticity that the brain might experience as a result of beekeeping, if it went along with some sort of beneficial effect in terms of behavior or cognition. This may seem somewhat trivial, but I don't think it is. It focuses people's attention on it. It focuses people's attention in a way that they might not have otherwise. I mean, there's a physical, chemical change taking place in the body. Not everyone would respond the same way to that, but there's a lot of people who, if they were presented with that information, they'd be more likely to take that seriously and to use that information to benefit their own health. And I don't think that's trivial. Another thing, though, I think is more important in terms of studying neuroplasticity, is that by understanding the principles around which it works, we can harness it better. For example, the timing of when different kinds of experiences are presented in relation to other, to the context that one is in, can have profound effects on whether or not something is neuroplastic or not. And by studying the way that the brain changes in these different with these different experiences, we can understand which of those. I mean, there are a lot of different things which seem beneficial in some people, but not in others. Why is there so much variability? That we can, by studying this, I think we're going to have the opportunity to reduce that variability in ways that can make certain treatments which seem not so beneficial be beneficial for a much larger group of people. So those are some reasons why I think neuroplasticity is awesome.
And I must say, I agree with you, Mark. I would go for both, even though you said it's not an option. Really, it is, because that's what's so wonderful about science, is we can answer multiple questions at a time. And I think these are very important questions to look into. Rebecca, you mentioned these veterans have PTSD, and we actually know that PTSD has a negative effect on the hippocampus. We're seeing that patients with PTSD actually have atrophy of their hippocampus from that trauma, and that's actually similar to depression. Depression tends to turn down our brain's neuroplasticity. And there's really exciting research going on as to, how we can reverse that. And I think one really interesting thing is that they've shown that some of the antidepressants that we use, these SSRIs, enhance neuroplasticity and neurogenesis. So this is really exciting. So I would love to know more about that. And in doing so, we can improve the lives of all these, anybody affected by these conditions, enhance our knowledge, and then they'll be able to tell more stories.
May I form an alliance on this side of the table?
Becky, don't do it.
Look, the brain is amazing. The fact that it changes is amazing. But we're talking about a space where we're not talking about science being able to do everything. I'm also a scientist. I just don't like scientism. That's the label we give to when we make science religion, because we have such faith in science to solve the problems. I work in the Alzheimer's and the Parkinson's space, so let me give an example from Alzheimer's. We are spending hundreds of billions, if you pull all the drug companies together with the NIH budget, or at least tens of billions, to finding the one magic answer with a drug to Alzheimer's disease. I don't think that's working, and most people are beginning to agree with that. And so the scientists are saying, well, we need to tackle this and that, and we need a cocktail of drugs. That's focusing on the brain. We need dementia and age-friendly communities. We need, pardon the plug, intergenerational public schools where people with dementia can go and interact with kids. I can assure you that is going to have an effect on the brain. It's also going to have an effect on quality of life. Neuroplasticity is a promise that's overhyped, in my opinion. And I'm not being critical, because it is a balance. We're all agreeing to that. But I think we're talking about a space where we have to begin to address priorities about what we want to do with older people and younger people and their brains in society.
Are you going to respond?
So Peter, I do agree with you so much on the importance of social connection and making, you know, including patients with memory disorders and dementia part of our community, because they do better. There's no doubt about it. My own mother had Alzheimer's, and it was very clear to me how social intervention, letting her express her humanity, spending time with others, you know, really enriched her life. But at the same time, I would love to see us really advance our understanding, you know, of memory disorders, of Alzheimer's disease. And, you know, maybe it's not one silver bullet. Maybe it's five silver bullets. I think we need to, you know, the more we understand how the brain works and the more we understand what's happening in memory disorders and in dementia, you know, what's actually happening at a cellular level in the brain, that's going to help us, you know, solve this problem. This has been, you know, the history of medicine and scientific advancement, you know, is looking at things from different angles.
Okay, I'm going to start with questions, and with you'd referenced Parkinson's and. So the first question is, in regards to Parkinson's disease, exercise or aerobic exercise, does it help the brain with neuron or neuroplasticity?
I guess we have two people that have talked about Parkinson's, but absolutely. One of the greatest programs that exists for people with Parkinson's is called Dance with Parkinson's. I have a friend in Canada who's doing MRI scans to see if it changes the brains of dancers or people who do that. But dance is a great intervention. It's social, it's story, it's physical. And I will say one other thing about Parkinson's that I agree with Mark. Alzheimer's is not one thing. It affects people very differently. So when we lump together and say we need one silver bullet or five silver bullets, the price is going up, they're gold now. The idea that that Parkinson's has some really strong environmental components to it, and you know, a parallel between Parkinson's and bees is whether the pesticides that we're putting into and the various chemicals we're putting into the various places in our world actually contribute to degenerative disease. And in that case, I would sooner get rid of the toxins in the environment than I would spend a lot of money figuring out how the toxins are affecting the brain. Not that that might not be irrelevant to, you know, working together.
You're trouble.
Right?
You're trouble.
I'm trouble? Well, let me ask you, so to address your bee problems, I now know that the bees have both hemispheres, because I was going to make some joke about bees and brains.
Did you Google them?
Yeah, I Googled them. I got a map of a bee right here. I don't know which kind of bee.
Body,
but here's my question to you. In sorting out the problem with the PTSD of bees, I mean, let's say we are really stressing out bees, how much I don't want to put anybody on the spot, and maybe I'm playing the devil's advocate too much, particularly because my wife thinks I'm an angel. How much do you think knowing the brain bee compared to trying to look at the picture in a kind of ecological way has advanced our saving our bees? You don't have to answer.
Yeah, and what I'd like to do is get back to questions.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Okay. Go for it. I
will quickly say, because I think you're all on the edge of your seat, but we can measure stress in bees, and we do, but their brains have about a million neurons. They're absolutely fascinating, and that'll be a topic, I think, that will for sure be next year here, right?
Right. You're sure to come back next year. I've gotten about 6 or 7 questions about subcultures, and I don't know if they're from 7 people or one person sent 7 questions, but because I have so many, I'm going to go with it.
Excuse me, Ellen, can I just make one point?
Oh, sure.
About exercise? This is so important. Of all the things that we can do to enhance our I believe neuroplasticity, but definitely shown to decrease our risk of developing dementia, improve our cognition, improve our brain resilience, is physical activity. Physical inactivity is thought to be the number one modifiable risk factor in the U.S. And this is what I encourage all my patients to do. I try to get some type of physical activity in every day. When you get your heart rate up, you know how you feel that flush in your face? That's from increased blood flow. The same thing is happening in your brain. There's increased blood flow in your brain, which is causing this cascade of these wonderful growth factors that promote neuroplasticity. Especially one of the ones, and I've talked about this before in other sections, is what's called BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor. And you can get this boost of BDNF just from physical activity. And it's been shown to help Parkinson's disease. There are just countless studies showing a really strong association between physical fitness and cognitive performance and a lower risk of dementia.
There's a great book on that, by the way. If you're interested in that topic, there's a great book called Spark that's written for a lay audience. I think it came out years ago or so.
They're developing a pill that works on brain-derived neurotrophic factor. You take the pill, you don't have to exercise.
You know what? We actually are.
You guys at Harvard
probably still should exercise.
Okay.
Now, in our last one of our last meetings at the Institute or the Center for Brain Health, we were talking about that. How can we do this? How can we enhance neuroplasticity? Is it possible that we'll be able to put BDNF in a pill? And just one other little anecdote: we also know that meditation, the way we think and use our brain, affects its physical structure and enhances our cognition. And one of my colleagues, Rudy Tanzi, who's one of the top Alzheimer's researchers, was telling me he had breakfast with the Dalai Lama, and they were talking about this research that we were looking to enhance our brains, and maybe someday we will have a medicine we can take to provide all these benefits that meditation provide, and the Dalai Lama said he would take that pill.
LSD.
Okay, I'm gonna skip over the subculture thing and give you a really easy one here, and it is: are males and females' brains functionally different? Who's going to jump into that one?
I think you should.
Yeah, go for it, Becky. What is the bee answer to that question?
Well, I think that, and I, I shouldn't be answering this question. I should not be answering this question, first of all. But I think that the answer is going to be in the hormones, isn't it? Part of it?
That's part of it.
Yeah.
Okay, that's it.
Yeah. There are physical differences, but the overlap is so great that it's unclear what those differences really mean. It's something that is a pretty hot topic of study, though. Just on a related note, recently the NIH did something which they should have done a very long time ago, which was to require that everybody getting grants through the NIH study both male and female subjects, which, believe it or not, the field at large, since it's started in the 50s or 60s in rodent research and other fields, was studying males, because the thought was that with female hormone cycling, that there would be too much variability, and that if that would make you'd have to use many more subjects to take care of that variability, and so why not just study the males and we won't even worry about that. Which is, when I started in the field, that was just the standard. That's just like everybody believed that. Well, not everybody believed it, but enough people believed it that was the standard of study. And that's changed. And so now everyone is required to study males and females. And so I think we're going to know a lot more about that pretty soon, because all the studies that people are doing now include both sexes, and we're starting to see some interesting differences in terms of what they mean and how to interpret them. It remains to be seen. Hormones are part of the picture. Genes are another part of the picture, though, and so sorting those two things out is a challenge.
On average, the male brain is bigger than the female brain. On average, Neanderthals had a bigger brain than Homo sapiens, which only tells you size is not everything.
But I would just like to say...
be careful. Walk carefully with the next response.
It's so important that we have changed the guidelines on this, and that females are being included in studies, because we do know the female brain. Well, maybe when you look at it physically, it's hard to find differences. But we know that it is very different, and is affected by hormones, the menstrual cycle. So there are studies looking at how females perform on tests at different stages in their menstrual cycle. So it actually does affect our mental clarity. And certainly around menopause, with all these changes in hormonal levels, we know that that affects it. And we also know that a number of diseases affect, some affect females more than males, some affect males more than females. And for example, with Alzheimer's disease, 2/3 of cases are female. And we do not feel this is fully explained by the fact that women live longer. Another interesting fact is that 2/3 of caregivers for dementia and for elderly are female. And one of the things I'm really interested in is how that affects the female brain. I wouldn't be surprised if that in itself becomes a risk factor.
It could be a cause and a cause or effect.
Yeah.
It could go either way.
Yeah. And then another factor is that when you're looking at dementia prevention, women have a much higher burden of modifiable risk factors compared to men. And so I think these are really important things to be aware of. And again, at our Center for Brain Health at Mass General, we're very mindful about including women in the studies. And also keeping track of, where they are in terms of their menstrual cycle and whether or not they've gone through menopause, whether or not they're taking hormonal replacement.
I started to talk or ask some of the questions about subcultures, but I'm not sure it is not more sociological than brain-centric. And I'm going to go to one that's a little bit more toward the brain, I think.
A question was sent in, does staying up late at night, you know, 1, 2 o'clock in the morning working, does that affect the brain, and if so, how?
So my last session tomorrow is on sleep. I think it's a hugely neglected area of study in general. We spend our time doing a lot of it, occasionally at the right time. Everything you do changes your brain. So the answer to any question you say, does this change your brain? It'll change your brain. So if you stay up late, I mean that, but I hate to get back to the cultural context, that does depend a little bit on the circumstance and what's going on. But I can tell you for sure, in our intergenerational schools, if our kids stay up late playing video games, they aren't coming to school to learn. And they lose an opportunity to learn. So that's my take on it. Absolutely. Sleep is important, and it affects your brain.
One of the interesting emerging research topics in the mental illness and neuroscience world is to what extent some of the symptoms of mental illness might be because of sleep disruption, you know, which isn't, as you say, as often studied and monitored, and so we don't know as much about it. But you know, we don't know why we have to sleep in the first place, which is but it does seem to be pretty beneficial. We all know that from our own experience. But this idea that that some of the problems in mental illness could come from sleep disruption, it suggests the possibility that if you could improve sleep, you might improve a whole bunch of other things without having to, you know, to find the silver bullet for all those other factors.
Well, does sleep not slough off during sleep? Are impurities not sloughed off?
Well, so I'm going to be on the panel with you, Peter, tomorrow morning on sleep.
Don't burn all your good information.
But yes, during sleep, our brain actually restores itself. It's kind of like the garbage collectors come in and take all the waste out of the cells, and there are all kinds of wonderful restorative changes that occur during sleep.
Although I think it's fair to say we don't understand exactly what, and I would also point out to dreaming, because dreaming is doing something interesting at reintegration.
Yeah.
And once again, and frankly, in the military, they were trying to develop pills to stop people from sleeping, or have them start and stop sleeping on the battlefield tempo. And again, it's a question of, do we push sleeping pills, which I certainly don't do in older people? Do we, and I'm sorry to keep coming back to the theme, but it is an issue of where in the social priorities we work on things. Sorry about that.
Yeah.
So I won't start over. I've been talking too much. But basically I was saying, we don't know what, as everybody agreed, we don't exactly know what sleep does. It obviously does something important. In the military, they were trying to understand that to make troops sleep on schedule. But the question I treat older people, the thing we try to do is avoid sleeping pills because they end up often causing more problems. So once again, it's an issue of biological understanding informs us, but the question in the world is, how do we behave towards trying to help people improve sleep?
Mm-hmm. I have a question for you, Rebecca. Do bees sleep?
I was thinking that.
I was going to grab the mic because I know at least two of you out there were interested, but now we have three.
Yes,
bees do sleep. And you can actually, there are some, some people, it might have, gardeners in the audience might have seen some male bees who actually will sleep on flowers. And so it actually does happen.
I wonder what they're dreaming about.
I didn't say they dreamt, so we don't know that.
Oh, okay.
Can you speak to the concept, this will maybe be a last question depending on how long the answers are. Can you speak to the concept of muscle memory? And if this concept can help verbal acuity in the brain, can you exercise the brain just as you can exercise other muscles or muscles rather than that?
You're looking at me, but I think...
I was talking to my mic and it was pointing
back. So one point is that I think everybody agrees, there are different kinds of memories, absolutely. I mean, people who can't remember what they had for breakfast can sit down and play a complicated piano piece, or they can go out and ride their bicycle. The interesting part for me of that question is how much does training in one area affect another area? And I'll leave that more difficult question to you folks, if you're interested in taking it on.
Yeah, so I think as I'm interpreting that question, it's like, can you think about training the brain like you can think about lifting weights? Is that one way to think about it, maybe? I'll take it that way. So I think there's a lot to be said for that. We don't have all the answers on that, but so Peter just posed the question of, if you brain training in one area, how much does it spread and help in other areas? It's an active area of research. So, for example, we were talking, we were on a panel the other day, we were talking about the brain games that you can find online and the apps, and to what degree, if you're training using those brain games, can that influence your cognitive power in other ways? And I think it's still an open question. Maria was saying the evidence isn't that good that it is useful yet, but there's some really interesting work from I'm forgetting his name at UCSF. I need to get back to that training. Okay, there you go. It'll come to me.
So my answer is yes, absolutely. That's what learning is all about. That's again how we build up our intellectual coffers. And there's no physiologic reason you can't continue to challenge yourself, challenge your brain to its potential throughout your life. And so I would encourage you to embrace mental challenge, you know, in work and in your leisure activities. It's important to use your memory. You know, a lot of people, as they get older, they complain, my memory's just not that good. And I always ask them, do you really practice memorizing things? You know, I think especially in this digital age, we don't remember telephones anymore. We depend on our GPS to bring us places. And memory is like any other skill. The more you practice, the better you will get at it. So I would, you know, encourage you to learn new skills. Take advantage of the courses that are offered here, that are the woman who kind of invited me here to speak at this event, she was telling me the University of Colorado at Boulder offers free classes for anyone 55 and older. That's an incredible opportunity for you to challenge your mind, and you will notice the difference. You know, seek daily enrichment as much as you can. One of the things I do is I try to watch a TED Talk once a week. I don't know if you know what TED Talks are, the technology, education, and design. These are little 18-minute videos for free online, and you can watch. They're given by, you know, the experts around the world in kind of every topic you can imagine. And it's just kind of a great way to expand your intellectual horizons. And I would encourage you to do everything you can to keep your brain sharp.
So I think exercise is another metaphor. I don't think the brain is a muscle, except in some people. And so exercise, what it means to exercise the brain is different than what it means to exercise the muscle. A lot of kids pay a lot of time on video games. The literature, as you just heard, on the value of that is not in. There has been no randomized controlled study that I know of participating in CWA, where the goal is a level of not just of improving your memory, but of improving your skills as a citizen. So once again, I would say I would certainly agree. But, you know, how much time you spend focusing on memory things online, or how much time you spend engaging with other people in conversations about what it means to be a citizen in this country, those are choices we have to make.
Thank you.
But you can do both.
Marie, Mark, Peter, and Becky, thank you so much for a wonderful meeting.